Okay. Then I would like to introduce the next presenter, Matthijs Blankers from the University of Amsterdam.
Okay, thank you very much. My name is Matthijs Blankers. I'm indeed working for the University of Amsterdam, more precisely for a research institute named the Amsterdam Institute for Addiction Research, which together with the Academic and Medical Hospital focuses mainly on research of the topic of addiction. First of all, I'd like to express my thanks to the organization of this conference for giving me the opportunity to discuss about my research project. And this project actually involves the performance of an internet-based randomized clinical trial. And I will tell you about our experiences in the performance of this trial and also present some preliminary results about participants and their adherence to the treatment. This internet-based trial compares two different treatments for people with alcohol-related problems, problem drinkers. Together with a waiting list, and the research design we'll show to you later on. First of all, I have to state that I have no conflicts of interest to declare here. So, as I said, I'm working for the Amsterdam Institute for Addiction Research, which is a Netherlands-based research institute. The Netherlands, as most of you might know, is a little country in the western of Europe, which is obviously famous for its windmills and its water protection systems. But also it's a rather small country with 60 million inhabitants, but with a lot of active internet users. So the figures here presented are from 2006, and probably the percentages are even higher right now. So around 75% of the population is a regular internet user. And about the same percentages of this group is also using the internet for searching healthcare information. So this makes this country, our country, an excellent opportunity to work with e-health interventions. Well, at the same time, in Western Europe, and Netherlands is included, alcohol leads to quite an extensive disease burden, according to the WHO. It is considered one of the main factors related to premature deaths, and this can be directly through the effects of alcohol use, being, for example, addiction, cardiovascular diseases, cancers, but also indirect effects, for example, accidents, traffic accidents, and especially for relatively young people, it's a common reason for disease or even worse. So the WHO calculated impact on public health only by alcohol is quite extensive. Around 4% of the global disease-adjusted life years is caused by alcohol. And for the Western Europe, this might be even a bit higher, as the European region has the highest alcohol intake worldwide. As I said, also for the Netherlands, this is the case. So on our 60 million inhabitants, we have an estimated 800,000 problematic alcohol consumers. And at the same time, we only see only a minority of this group actually being in treatment. In 2007, for example, 32,000 people were treated in some way for alcohol-related problems. So that's only about 4% of people actually in need of some form of treatment or the need of changing their drinking habits. So this leads actually to a large what we call treatment gap, so a gap between those who are in need of some form of treatment or in need of changing their drinking habits and those who are actually being helped in doing so. So this is where e-mental health comes into play. Because the three reasons stated here, We think that that using the internet for providing help to this population might enlarge the proportion of people with drinking problems who actually will get help. Obviously, and we have seen from primary results that we can attract kind of a new group to these internet interventions. So we seem to be successful in addressing an underserved target population. Well, at the same time, obviously with an eye on cost, as we've just recently heard by the speech of Viola, it is also conceivable that through more self-management of diseases, you have a lot labor-intensive therapy for the therapists, which leads to less cost. So with the same amount of money invested in healthcare, you can treat more people. And at the same time, you will improve self-efficacy of those who are in need of treatment. So they learn to change problematic aspects of their lives themselves. And the third reason why email to health will be useful in this area is it extends its choice. So there are more options for in this case, problem drinkers to select from. So this has led to quite a use of the internet in mental health in the Netherlands. The figures here presented are only for alcohol, and Helene Rieper, who's also with us today, has in 2007 published quite an overview of the use of e-mental health in the Netherlands. And she reported, for example, around 18 online interventions for problematic alcohol users. So for our population, that's quite a much. So primary focus is not probably on developing more different programs, but on improving them and obviously on finding out whether they're effective. Currently, only 1 in 7 of these interventions is thoroughly researched and found evidence-based. So actually, we have some sort of knowledge gap, to speak of gaps, for the alcohol interventions on whether they're effective or not. So the best way to research whether an intervention is effective is a randomized clinical trial in which you compare the provision of this form of healthcare treatment to problem drinkers with a group you will not treat for a certain amount of time. So after this period, you can see whether the treated group has improved more than the untreated group, and then obviously you know that your program is efficacious. So this is actually what we are going to do. We have two different treatment programs for people with alcohol problems, and these two programs are we going to compare with an untreated waiting list. The first program, and I'm going to tell you about them shortly, is a self-help program. For this program, the participant can, in normal context, participate anonymous. The only thing he or she has to inform about is an email address. There's no counselor involved. It's a fully self-guided treatment program. So that means the participants are working with the program all by themselves. There's a forum involved so they can have interactions with each other. So actually the deployment of this program leads to wide possibilities of reaching a large group of people with drinking problems, which are very accessible. As there's unrestricted access for everyone to these programs, we hope and we have experienced that it's possible to attract quite a large part of the problem drinking population to these sort of interventions. And then we also have another program, which is more extensive, actually a therapy program. This one is not anonymous. People have to inform on their personal information, for example, healthcare policy information, insurance policy information. But here's a counselor involved. So besides the elements which are also involved in the self-help program, up to 7 one-on-one chat sessions with a trained counselor are a part of this treatment program. So this makes it more intensive and more like the regular outpatient treatment setting, but fully online. This is a small screenshot of the self-help program. Tomorrow, together with Udo Nabic, I will be presenting a poster, for example, on this program. So if you're interested in the precise working of the several elements which are involved, I would like to invite you to come attend the poster session. But in short, there are actually four different pathways which are discernible and which are included in this program. The first is purely the provision of information on problem drinking and on changing problem drinking habits, on coping with stress, with maybe withdrawal symptoms, or for example craving. Another aspect very important is the registration of alcohol use. So people who are working with this problem are expected to log in to the program and report what they have been drinking the day before, or a couple of days before. And a nice thing is, and that's actually depicted here, that these reported alcohol uses, together with set goals before they started working with the program, are graphically fed back to them. So they actually get a sort of insight in their drinking habits, which may help them identify situations in which drinking is especially problematic for them. Another aspect, of course, is communication. And in the self-help program, this is mainly with other program participants through the included forum. So they can post messages about their experiences with stopping drinking or with working with the program, and others can react on that. So this makes an interactive part of this treatment program. This screenshot is from the therapy program. It looks quite similar, with, of course, the important difference that there's a chat functionality involved in this program. So besides the elements that participants can do by themselves, there's also up to 7 chat sessions, one-on-one, so that's the client and the counselor, in which there's personal attention for the problems the participant or the client has run into, and in which the counselor can actually advise the client on how to continue its attempt to change the drinking habit. So it's actually more like the regular treatment context, face-to-face, but then online. Now we're going over to the research part, actually. This is a small screenshot of the trial website we have developed for the research we are doing. Everything from the inclusion of participants to obtaining informed consent, screening, randomization is performed online. So that makes it very protocol strict and also not too overly labor intensive. Also the data collection of the pre and the post measurements is done online. So both the treatment, therapy or self-help process, and the research process is performed online in actually the same environment. Visitors of this website were attracted through the website of the ELINAC, which is the Amsterdam Addiction Treatment Center, are introduced to the programs. And if they think they're interesting for them to participate, they can do a short screening questionnaire. It takes about 3 minutes, and we'll let them know whether they're the persons we're looking for in this trial or whether we think another form of treatment is more effective for them. Actually, we were including participants between age 18 and 64 with an audit score of higher than 8. And audit is a screening instrument for problematic alcohol use, and scores of 8 and higher are considered problem drinkers, or at least probably problem drinking participants. Also, participants had to report more than 14 drinks in the week before they subscribed to the trial. They were not expected to have had prior treatment, so if they reported to have been in more intensive, more heavy treatment programs, they were excluded. And also people with severe comorbidity or extensive polydrug use were excluded. So actually we were aiming on a group with alcohol as the main substance of abuse and no other mental or addiction problems, who had not been in treatment before. So of course we had several expectations in the trial, from which the flowchart I will show you in a couple of minutes, about how the participants would be doing when they were going to our treatment program. We expect that the participants in the treatment program, which is more intensive and more extensive, to have a larger reduction in alcohol consumption than the participants in the self-help program. Also, we're looking at quality of life, working abilities, and also here we expected a bigger effect in the therapy group than in the self-help group. At the same time, we didn't only expect these effects to be larger, but also to be maintained for a longer period of time as a result of the more intensive treatment process. And also we're planning to do a cost-effectiveness analysis, of which Viola has just told us very interesting information. We currently have no preconceptions whether it will favor the therapy program or the self-help program. This is mainly because we expect the therapy program to be more effective, but also to be more expensive. So the equation could be the same, or at least it's difficult to preconcept whether it will favor one or the other. And also we're going to do an extensive evaluation of the participants of this program. We expect them, based on previous research, to be relatively well functioning. And in the remainder of the speech, I will show you whether this indeed was the case. This, for short, are the screening instruments which are used in our research project. I'm not going into them very deep. Some of you may know them, some of you won't. Most important thing is to state that we are measuring alcohol, so purely the consumption, in the last 7 days and in the last month. And also we're going to do the audit test several times to see whether alcohol-related problems are changing over time. We're going to look at quality of life using two different measurement scales. The goal is kind of effective in finding small changes in subclinical populations. And the EQ5D has a health utility index, so it can easily be compared to health in the general population. And then we're looking at some secondary aspects of quality of life. Actually, quality of work is measured by two measurement scales. We're looking at the brief symptom inventory to see whether there is a co-occurrence of mild symptoms of other disorders and whether they change over time. And we're looking at the alliance between the therapist and the client and to see whether a good empathic connection is being developed and whether this is of influence of the treatment program and obviously the outcome. All these measurement instruments are measured at baseline, so that's actually before treatment is provided, and at the several follow-ups. We've incorporated, actually, there are depicted here two, but actually three follow-up moments. One is after 3 months, one is after 6 months, and also after a year we're going to see whether the treatment effects we found for the therapy program remain over a longer period of time. As I said before, the screening and informed consent is obtained online. And this is actually what we see in the upper two boxes. Then after they informed consent and provided all the necessary information, the baseline measure is taken. This is quite an extensive questionnaire of about 45 minutes, which the participants fill out online. And only after completion of this pre-measurement, they are randomized over the three different groups. It could be that they're allocated to trial arm one, and in this case they will right away receive the therapy online treatment. It could also be that they're allocated to the second arm, in which they're going to work with the self-help program. And the third group is placed on a waiting list, only for 3 months, but on the other hand, that's quite a period of time for people in need. But this is really important to know whether the two treatments we provide are more effective than not treating them. Obviously, all the participants know before they start participating in this program that this randomization will occur, and they consented with this procedure, so it's not something they run into during participation. They can decide before they start whether they think this is acceptable or not. Then after the 3 month, so the first follow-up measurement, the participants who were on the waiting list are sent to the therapy online, so they, after 3 months, received the treatment they were willing to receive. And the two other arms are followed for another 3 months, in which they do not get any treatment, but in which period of time we can see whether the treatment effects remain if they occur. Obviously, a big risk in these forms of longitudinal designs is that participants drop out of the study, that you measure them at baseline but can't measure them at the follow-ups. And it is conceivable that there's a selection in who is willing to do the follow-ups and who isn't. So it's very important for us to attain as large as possible proportion of participants in the treatment and in the trial. So therefore, we're not doing the follow-ups only via the internet. We're inviting them through the internet, but if they don't respond, we also are going to telephone them, and we're working together with the call center of Jelinek Arkin, which is running now for a couple of years and experienced in reaching hard-to-reach populations. And normally they phone everybody in treatment in the addiction treatment center after 9 months to see whether how they're doing. And obviously still then some attrition will occur. We know from before that it's sometimes difficult, even if you have phone numbers, to get into contact with the participants. So we also have prepared some statistical means of handling with the dropout of data. Multiple imputation is the method we are intending to use. And we're currently working on a paper in which we compare different methods of multiple imputation, especially for a data set like this, to see whether which methods gives us the most accurate results. So we think we, in this way, have worked on the issue of potential dropout to the maximum that we are able to. Now I'm going to some preliminary results. This is actually the same flowchart that you have seen a minute ago, but now with the figures printed inside. So what we're seeing is that we recruit about 500 participants each month. These are unique new participants who, for some reason, are interested in our website, and a proportion is doing the screening phase. So we have had up until the 1st of February, when we generated this baseline data, 1,169. Participants or enthusiasts who were doing the screening questionnaire, and of which a large, actually the majority, did not meet inclusion criteria or was excluded for another reason. As you can see, more or less half of them did not meet the inclusion criteria we set for this treatment program, and we referred them to other forms of treatment. Also, there was around 400 participants who refused to participate, and this probably mainly has to do with the randomization and the possibility of coming to a waiting list, which we informed them on in this phase. Also, for some of them, we did not receive informed consent, and there were some other reasons for people rejecting their participation. So of 153, at the 1st of February, we did a first baseline measurement. And all of these participants were directly after the completion of this measurement randomized over the three different arms. So they started with the therapy or the self-help program or did not receive treatment up until that moment. And after 3 months were invited to the first follow-up measurement. And as you can read from these figures, we maintained up until now around 67% of the participants in the trial after 3 months, of which you can say it's much or it's not much, but at least it's, from the simulations we have run until now, enough to maintain accurate results. The six-month follow-up figures are not printed here yet. We are collecting them right now, and the follow-up rates are comparable, somewhat lower, but comparable to the ones we've seen at the three-month follow-up. Now we're going over to some of the baseline characteristics of our participants. What we see is that around half of the participants is female. So this seems like a normal distribution, but actually it reflects a lot of use of this program by female participants, as compared to the regular treatment population, it's about 80% men and 20% women. So it seems, and that has been concluded before, that we tend to attract relatively much women to this form of treatment. Their age is about 43 on average, and they're relatively high educated. Two-thirds of them has a bachelor degree or higher, and this is also remarkable because in the regular face-to-face treatment, education levels seem to be lower usually. The majority has a paid job, which is obviously interesting, as it seems to be people who are quite good integrated in society, but on the other hand have severe drinking problems, which they like to receive help. That's what we also conclude from the number of drinks they report per week before they participate. It's around 44 on average, which, at least in my opinion, is much, and according to the WHO standard, is way too much to be conscious from a health perspective. The audit score is around 19, so that's quite high if you consider that 8 is already a cutoff for problematic alcohol use. And the duration of their drinking problems is around 6 years on average. The QOL, which is the quality of life score, is around 72, and for normal healthy participants on this schedule, it's considered 85 is normal. So there's room for improvement on this scale as well. Now, obviously, we have randomized the participants over three groups, so it is very important that this has happened in some sort of balanced way and that no differences on these aspects have occurred over the three groups. And luckily, these are the test statistics. For some of these are chi-square tests and others are one-way ANOVAs. And we have seen that none of these important baseline characteristics differ over the three groups. So on the figures I presented here, the three randomized groups are comparable. Then this sheet is showing something about the treatment adherence. We expected from the hypothesis that the therapy program depicted below here, the TAO, would be more intensive than the self-help program. And actually, when looking at the number of visits to the program and the number of days participants remain active in the program, this seems to be the case. On average, the participants of the treatment program have around 4 chat sessions with a counselor. So there seems to be quite a difference in the amount of treatment provided in the two different treatment programs. So if indeed there's some sort of relation between the amount of treatment given and the effect, you would expect to find these effectual differences here. So obviously, I would really like to present more data on the outcome of this study, but For this moment, it's still a bit early. We are hoping to include the last participants in the next month of this year. So then in a year time, we have full 1 year follow-up data. And the half-year follow-up data will be ready in full 2009. So maybe later on this year, I can tell you about the clinical outcome of this trial. For now, we can conclude that the methodology we have designed and the software we programmed is efficient. It's working as it's intended to. Inclusion rates, which for some studies may be problematic sometimes, were more than sufficient. Attrition is kept within acceptable range thanks to the methods of the using call center and the statistical methods. And as I said, the outcome will be expected later this year and next year. So to quit, one of the, in my opinion, wonderful things, except from the strict methodology processes, is also the fact that doing a randomized trial over the internet, your data is accessible from everywhere over the world. So, for example, in December of 2008, I was traveling to Asia, and this is me in front of the University of Luang Prabang, which is the cultural capital of Laos. And walking inside this building and sitting behind the computer over there, I was able to answer questions of my research participants to see whether the inclusions were going as expected to and to stay in contact with the therapist. So actually my managing of the trial continues wherever I am. So this is what I wanted to tell you about my research project. Obviously, I'm not working alone, so in this place I would like to thank my working group who are presented over here. And if there are any questions, I would be happy to answer them in a minute.
Maybe I missed it, but how many people do you have to include for sufficient power?
Yeah, I didn't tell you that yet. We have a minimum of 150 participants that we need. So actually, we're already over the minimum we need. But we decided to somewhat overpower the trial in order to do some interesting secondary analysis.
So only 50 persons per arm?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, and it's including... It's also including the attrition?
Well, because of the attrition, we now know that we remain from the 100% power for which we need 50 participants. With current dropout figures, we remain 85%. So that means we should include 15%, so let's say around 60 participants per cell. And this obviously is one of the reasons why we are overpowering slightly our trial.
And the attrition rates, is that representative of other alcohol studies?
As far as I know, it's representative for especially internet-based trials and also in other forms of addiction research you see comparable figures of dropout. But obviously, it really changes from one study to the other, but it's more or less normal, yeah.
And do you know the main reasons for people dropping out?
Not yet. We're intending to do more elaborated, let's say, dropout analysis. But obviously, because people are not responding anymore to invitations, it's quite difficult to find out why they quit. But that's why we're trying to solve this issue also in a statistical manner, in which, in fact, baseline characteristics of these participants who are dropout are compared to those mm-hmm. who don't drop out. And this is actually taken into account to come to representative results from all the data which is available.
And the people who dropped out, they haven't logged on to the website? So after randomization, they were just...
And there's a difference between dropping out of the study and dropping out of the research project, obviously. So people can have been active in the program for a while and then don't respond to the treatment program or may have stopped altogether after randomization. That's all possible, and we know most participants were indeed active in the direction we intended them to, but both obviously happen sometimes, yeah.
Okay.
I have actually a question in the line of the previous person, because if you look at the three conditions, the third condition will be lost, because you give the waitlist condition, after 3 months they get access to the intervention.
Yeah.
So in fact you hold two conditions for the 6 months and 12 months.
That's correct.
Results, if I'm correct. Now if you look at the potential effectiveness or the difference in effectiveness between the treatment and the self-help condition.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still curious if your power calculation is correct, because we know that we can expect an effect size around, middle-groot, around 0.40 for self-help intervention. So,
we performed and we've published our trial protocol, so in BMC Public Health. So for anyone who's more interested in the figures, can find it over there. We did an F-test omnibus power analysis, in which we set the power on 80, the alpha on 0.05, and in which we wanted to be able to find effects as small as 0.25 on effect size, Pearson error.
An effect size of the treatment intervention of 0.65?
No. The minimum, the amount of treatment effect we can find in this trial with a B of 0.80 and an alpha of 0.05 is 0.25, and this is because we don't know whether the difference between the self-help and the therapy program is whether we can expect it to be large or small, and 0.25 is more or less the bottom line of what's still considered to be clinically relevant as a change. So that's why we're a little bit lower than the 40 you mentioned.
Yeah, but it's the difference between the two groups. So if you, well, we can talk about later, but if you expect already, you know, from the self-help interventions, it's around 0.40, mm-hmm. the difference you need to find between the two, you need a lot of power. But
yes, but I think our power analysis is accurate. But if you have different ideas, I'll be happy to discuss them with
okay.
you.
I have a question. It's an honor to be on your list. It's really a perfect presentation. Compliments. The visits you were describing, there are 6 visits at the internet site
mm-hmm.
Of the self-help group, and there are 14 visits of 17 visits.
Yeah.
So what is a visit? What is counted as a visit?
A visit is the moment a participant who has a username and a password for the entrance in the program, and the moment he or she logs in with his username and password into the program, that is counted as a visit. So it's the number of times a participant logs into the program. Obviously we can find out what they're doing, and for secondary analysis it obviously can be very interesting. But for now, I don't know by heart what they're doing. We know that a large amount of the times they're registering former alcohol use, but obviously there are also other elements in the treatment program on which they could be working. Okay, thank you very much.
So, is Kathleen Dirk-Palumbo here? No? Well, then I guess we'll go on to the health break. Thank you very much for attending this workshop.